All right, here we are at, let's see, 31st, October, 1955, 4th London ACC. Want to talk to you today about how to audit, conduct of an auditor, what an auditor ought to do, and why he oughtn't to do it. First and foremost, we have to understand that what we are trying to improve in the preclear is not the number of ways he can think. But we're trying to improve the number of choices he can make. We got that clearly? Not the number of thinks he can do, but the number of choices he can do. You got it? Now, if you go on the number of thinks he can do, you'll be running back in Dianetic days. Dianetic days, an individual who had a heavy engram containing a certain phrase was not able to think that, or it obsessively thought against him. And therefore, we had to do something about or get rid of these various phrases. And having to get rid of these phrases was an arduous and long task. Today, we can evidently take out the entire reactive mind, lock, stock, and barrel, if we want to. And if we can take out the reactive mind straight across the boards without disturbing the physical anatomy of the being, which happens to be the case, we should ask ourselves why we should worry about limitations of think. It's quite important, you see. We have to take up right away what happens then on this power of choice as appertains to the reactive mind. Now, you understand the reactive mind is all there. It's been there straight on through. It never has disappeared just because I changed my mind. It's still around. It still has engrams, facsimiles, locks, secondaries, chains, basic basics. It still has phrases. It still has groupers, holders, bouncers. It still has the whole cockeyed works. And it is one of the more interesting booby traps that you ever wanted to run into. Now, people have been of the opinion, particularly psychoanalysm and psychology and other branches, and this was their one error, they have been of the opinion that the reactive mind was necessary for an individual to produce in the society. There is a book to this effect in the United States called Be Glad You're Neurotic. There are many such books. Freud made the terrific alibi. It was no more than an alibi. It was not a scientific fact. And this is not an attack on Freud. It is just an effort to ask you if you have this concept, to realign this concept, if you please. Freud made this alibi because he could not get directly at it. He said it was necessary and valuable to the conduct of the individual. Neurosis was necessary to the production of art forms. This has been with us too long and will upset you as an auditor if it is still sneaking around somewhere in your vicinity, because it will tell you that you should not amputate the entirety of the reactive mind. It said you should keep some part of it. Let me assure you that man is basically good, but the reactive mind foists upon him the suppositions, misowned, that he is evil. Therefore, he can act evilly. A man is as dead as he acts with bad intent, except when he acts with no intent at all and is incapable of an intent, and then he is below death. Now, this is an important thing to you. It gives you, if you understand this, the clearest possible picture of what you are trying to do, and should give you at once a complete category of things not to do. Here is this subject, the reactive mind. Here is this thing, this entity, this actuality called the reactive mind. It's a stimulus-response mechanism. It tells the individual what not to do more than it tells him what to do. It is a thing of death. All the bad intentions the individual will ever accumulate are in that reactive mind. It will not assist him in one degree. It will not assist the police to control the criminal. Quite on the contrary, it makes the criminal. It will not assist the husband or the wife to be more moral. It in itself makes them immoral. Now here is the panorama of existence of a great many people who are only three-quarters alive, half alive, one-quarter alive, and that is to this degree, to the degree that their power of choice has been overcome. The reactive mind is an entirety of record of overcoming of choice, and that is the totality of its source, the totality of its operation, the totality of its reaction. One's power of choice has been overcome by force, and it is a picture of the times one's power of choice has been overcome by force, and that it is all the picture, that is all the picture there is there, and that is all the pictures there are in it. This is one of the more interesting things. It is an interesting simplicity. If you can grasp this as a simplicity, you will have grasped actually all you need to know about auditing. The reactive mind has as its totality of content moments when the power of choice of the individual have been overcome by force. If you understand then that this thing triggers into action only on a stimulus response mechanism, you will equally understand that it will only trigger into action at those times when the auditor overcomes the power of choice of the individual who is being audited. By force, duress, over-persuasion. And you will see that the times this occurs, your preclear will then go into a reactive state. Now, actually, that's all you need to know about auditing. That's all you need to know as far as prevention is concerned. If you wish to prevent a bad occurrence in auditing, then do not overcome the preclear's power of choice by exertion of time or effort contrary to his decision. Yes, we know he may be mad, he may be half screaming, he may be this and he may be that, but at the same time, we must not overcome his power of choice. If we do, we kick into action his reactive mind. That is all there is to it. How then do we get a preclear to change his mind if we ourselves are not permitted to overcome his power of choice? The techniques and processes of auditing are all of them gauged in the direction of permitting a regain of power of choice one way or the other, so that the individual discovers that he can make choices without liability. With this clarity of understanding, we could probably rework the entirety of auditing, paying no attention to anything except rehabilitation of the power of choice. We probably could do this. However, we have an empirical series of processes, each one of which works and seems to do this on its own. And in view of the fact that the human mind is very complex, it is much wiser to use things which have been proven to be useful than it is to use things which are solely theoretical. I'm engaged at this time in improving processes which do improve the power of choice, working on it very hard. But there is no guarantee that these processes will work widely. There is every guarantee that the six levels of processing will work widely for the good reason that they have worked widely. And so on this criteria alone, we can expect that we will continue certain activities of auditing, even though they do not seem to be, at first glance, an improvement in power of choice. Actually, they do result in a power of choice. They must result in some intricate power of choice improvement. Otherwise, the individual at no time will be uptone for reason of having been run on them. So they must do this. If they work, they must do this. But what is there that goes alongside of all techniques that means as much as the techniques? And that is the auditor and his ability to audit. What is an ability to audit? It is an ability to persuade an individual to regain his power of choice without using upon him unexpected circumstances, surprises, and duress. If you can avoid unexpected circumstances, surprises, and duress with regard to the individual in his auditing, if you can smoothly bring him up into a higher level of choice, if you can bring him into a sphere whereby he is cognizant now of the fact that he can exercise wider choices than before, you will have gained a clear. And if you have brought him up by a type of auditing which overthrew his power of choice at every turn, then you will end up without a clear. As a matter of fact, you will end up with somebody with his reactive bank in restimulation. This is the exact mechanism of why the turn-on of a somatic during auditing is undesirable and is actually the mark of a bad auditor. A somatic only turns on at those times when the power of choice of the individual has been upset by the auditor. It's very fascinating when we look at it in this level of simplicity. It's one of these things that one would discover is very hard to miss. Now, why can an auditor make any kind of a gain with a preclear at all? If he's never permitted to overcome the preclear's power of choice, how then can the auditor, directly controlling the preclear, ever make any gain whatsoever with the preclear's power of choice? Well, number one, he must bring the preclear to the decision to be audited. He must not audit the preclear against the preclear's decision to be audited, because that would be the first power of choice which is there to be overcome. And therefore, he must persuade the preclear one way or the other that auditing is good and that it will take the preclear somewhere. That's what we find. Therefore, the preclear who is shoved at you is not going to gain as rapidly as the preclear who comes to you of his own free will. Now, how did the preclear come to you of his own free will in the first place? He read something in a book, usually something written by me, or he heard some friend talk about it, and he decided that he wanted some of this. Well, what made him decide to want some of this? It's because it paralleled his basic desires. His basic desires is to be better, to be more able, and to regain a freer power of choice. And when he read that this was possible through auditing, he therefore wanted to be audited. Some people are so contrary-wise and so downscale that they do not believe a power of choice in themselves or anyone else is of any benefit whatsoever, and they're directly aberrated on that. That's about 30% of the preclears, and they never come in to be audited. They think a restoration of power of choice is the worst thing that could ever happen. These individuals, unfortunately, agglomerate themselves into positions of power in a society. They are the slave masters. And they believe that people's power of choice must be overcome at every hand for the benefit of the state or the police department or the trustees' raises or the tax collector or somebody or something, you see. And here is an entire philosophy running through the society. But these people, oddly enough, believe that the power of choice should be upset for everyone else but should not be upset for themselves. So they too can be persuaded into being audited by simply asking them why they don't want to be audited. They will explain this and eventually see that there's something aberrated about their explanation. Now, that's the first step, and we won't go into this particular rough case. It's an interesting thing, but these individuals sooner or later come to you. Their powers of choice on an overt act motivator sequence have gone by the board, so they themselves feel like they're in terrible shape. They'll eventually come around and they say, "My God, why did I work so hard to destroy this clinic or this center or this science, because now it's the only thing that can save my bacon." A very, very interesting thing occurred with relationship to this in the United States. A man's father was dying, and this man had been so violently opposed to Dianetics and Scientology that he could not sleep at night until he had dreamed up some new way to rid the world of this horrible thing. This man was a power-hungry paranoid. He was a madman. He himself, I say that without reservation, he was a madman, but he was one of these functioning madmen. And these are interesting people to meet. They still seem to be functioning, and yet they are intent on nothing else but controlling everything in sight, owning everything in sight, upsetting everybody, and doing no possible good. They're not even there. They're three-quarters dead. One of their interesting symptoms, this will make you laugh because it seems to be so out of sequence, but they are unable to have regular bowel movements. That seems all offbeat, doesn't it? Oh, no, it isn't. They're trying to hold on to everything. They're trying to drain the world down of energy and everything that comes in their vicinity. They're trying to squeeze it dry of energy, whether that be a human being, whether it be a business or anything else. They cannot construct anything. All they can do is bleed things and drain them of energy. This is a fantastic thing. Well, this was this man. And this man did not rest day and night. He just worked, worked, worked. It was a fantastic thing to watch this. And he did everything that he could. This is no comment from my viewpoint other than simply the truth, because the individual did do a great deal of harm to Dianetics and Scientology. And it swept along to a point of where he removed out of existence the center, which was in his immediate area. He made life so tough. He had so much influence with the police, who were so much of his way of thinking. And the actuality of it was that he, without his immediate influence, nothing would have happened to the center, which was in his vicinity. But he wiped it out, and then his father started to die. And he sent me a telegram asking me to come and audit his father. And the oddity is I did. But here was something interesting. His father, fairly human, but at the same time beset by this and other sons, and beset by his wife, had had nothing happen to him for the last 20 years but have his own power of choice upset. And he wanted to die, so here was another power of choice. Here was another power of choice, to live or to die. And to have made this man live in an inhospitable atmosphere, such as he existed in, would have been an unkindness indeed. So we talked it over, the old man and I, and he kicked the bucket. But here's an oddity. And here is a grim fate. This broke up this fellow, something fantastic. This fellow went into apathy. He had been fighting the better part of himself, one might say. And he came to disaster because of it. The man today is not sane. He himself is watched closely by his own relatives for fear of self-destruction. Now, why do I bring up such an example of this? Because there are such men. But these men are, you will discover, uniformly, not themselves. They are far, far out of valence. They are dramatizing against themselves, and they fight Scientology because if they study it at all, they discover it is the better part of themselves. You see that? They're fighting themselves. They will also fight anything which seems to attempt a betterment of the power of choice in society, or increase the freedom of the society. These men are in terror, and when you start to audit them, you confront, in a very short while, terror. Now that, unfortunately, is a very large percentage. I'd say 30% of the human race has gotten to this ebb. These people are borderline cases, and unfortunately are very often found in high places. How would you handle such a person? Here's the most critical case you ever had anything to do with. How would you handle such a man? He doesn't want auditing. The lives of people in his immediate vicinity depend on this individual's getting some auditing. He will scream to high heaven if his son or daughter or wife is being mishandled in some fashion, and yet he will accuse the auditor of mishandling, and at the same time, the oddity is that this man himself will be the person who is unstabilizing the case. That's because he doesn't understand. His understanding is gone already before he starts this dizzy spiral. He spends all of his time plotting on how to upset the power of choice of the wife or the son or the daughter. This man is actively engaged in upsetting power of choice. To audit him, even vaguely, one has to upset his power of choice to this degree that it is senseless to go on upsetting everybody else's power of choice. And he will work this game on you as an auditor. He will decide that you have to have your power of choice upset too. This is all he knows how to do. The funny part of it is he has no motive but that. And you can look in vain for his deep-seated convictions, motives or otherwise, but his deepest motive is a necessity to upset someone's power of choice. That sounds completely idiotic, but it is true. Now, as we look over this, we find that occasionally in auditing, we get somebody, unfortunate, but he slides down scale to a point where he's obsessively trying to alter power of choice by force or duress in order to bring people lower on the scale than higher on the scale. Now, by the way, he's doing this knowingly. He isn't operating on a subconscious motive. He doesn't think people ought to be as free as they are. And when this man starts auditing, he very seldom stays anywhere in the vicinity of other auditors. He goes off. We occasionally get his cases. And the only thing wrong with these cases is that in the process of being audited, their powers of choice have been upset. The rehabilitation of those cases, of course, is to rehabilitate, as in any other case, the power of choice. That is all. But here, auditing itself has been used to upset power of choice. Now, what do we do to regain this? Well, it is fortunately a relatively simple thing. Simply get the confidence of the individual and bring him into the knowledge that you are not going to force any conclusion upon him. And if he can understand this, finally, he will then feel that there is some possibility of betterment. This reactive computation must upset the power of choice is the motto of the reactive mind. If the reactive mind has any motto at all, which it doesn't have, it would nevertheless have that as a motto. Must upset the power of choice. This means then that if the individual wants to eat, the reactive mind will tell him to sleep. If he wants to sleep, the reactive mind will tell him to wake up. If he wants to be well, the reactive mind will try to make him be sick. And if he wants to be sick, the reactive mind will even force him over into a manic sort of wellness. It's fantastic, but it's just an open and shut case of must alter the individual's intentions. Now, the reactive mind is merely accumulation of energy, masses, and ridges. But it has been installed, and it itself appears to have a certain liveness. Remember, every point of contact between the individual and the reactive mind, particularly the deepest points of contact, are moments when force has overcome the power of the individual. And so, those points of contact appear themselves to have an individuality. They appear to work autonomously in the most interesting fashion you ever wanted to investigate. They appear to be alive. There appears to be something thinking and acting there. There is no life there. It is simply a moment on the time track when the individual's power of choice was completely overturned. And therefore, even the tiny energy ergs left in residue to mark the incident now seem to have power of choice over the individual. No living being is there. And so we get the manifestations in pre-clears of demons and devils and things that go boom in the night, which aren't there at all. The actuality is there are these little connecting links, each one of which apparently has a power of choice over the individual. There's nothing live there. It's a force has the power of choice, you see? So every time you, as an auditor, upset the pre-clear's power of choice, you upset these little points of connection between the individual and his reactive mind, and these almost conceive themselves to be re-empowered again, and the reactive mind cuts loose and hits at the individual and produces somatics. And that, in essence, is what a somatic is. It's an old energy mass reactivated by the individual's power of choice having been overset by the environment or, in the special case of auditing, by an auditor. We can always chase down the track and discover the moment when the preclear got this particular illness, and we will discover inevitably that it was a moment when his power of choice was overset. He wanted to go, let us say, he wanted to take a bus, and he was forced to take a taxi. It's as silly as this, you know. But somebody made a big point of this. Nobody advanced any reason. There wasn't any communication on it at all. Somebody merely forced him to take a taxi. And we find the individual didn't feel well. Somebody said, well, we'll take a taxi. That's that. Shut up. They took a taxi. And a couple of days later, this individual doesn't feel well. We say, isn't this idiotic? I mean, little tiny thing like, well, that individual being kind of bad shape if his power of choice was so sensitive. But what it did was key in some part of the reactive bank. And now we have a reactive mind in action trying to drive the individual even further out of connection with the environment. Now, the reactive mind is composed of energy. Energy and space. And the energy and space of it combine to make a sort of time track all its own. Now, an individual gets on to this, or you might say this artificial, this ambiguous sort of time track. It's not a time track. It is a time track. Things are timed. They aren't timed, you know, and he has no control over any of this. And the individual gets in connection with this. It is forced on him in some fashion or another. And he himself loses power over energy. Now, how did he do this in the first place? He was trying to take care of a piece of space, energy, time manifestation, and against his power of choice, this was destroyed. So the funny part of it is the central core of the reactive mind we discover to be some tiny piece of energy which the individual is trying still to protect. It's a great oddity that he will hold on this long and go this far and suffer this much, simply to protect some tiny energy or consideration. We find some preacher still trying to protect his baby brother, for instance. Nearly everything that's happened since, and the baby brother's long since married and gone and so forth, and we find out that everything has happened since has found this individual still protecting his baby brother. You see, the time track doesn't go along with base time messed universe. But when his baby brother's power of choice was overset, he felt his power of choice was overset, you see. And so we get these vias. And it becomes a very complicated thing if we tried to trace it down bit by bit. So, there's an oddity here that we must not particularly study or work with the reactive mind, even though we're working straight at it. What we work toward is increasing the individual's power of choice and ability to make decisions. And this we increase. We show him that he can live in the physical universe, that he can handle a body, and that he can think and walk and talk without his power of choice being overset. But if we always have to hand an auditor who is ambitiously oversetting his power of choice, just because the individual did not want to run this anymore is the best reason why it should be run and so forth, you see. We say to ourselves that the auditing itself then becomes a course or cause of aberration. It is oversetting the individual's power of choice. Now, the individual, by choice, has given his case over into the hands of somebody else. We have to establish the existence of the auditor, the preclear in the session. Otherwise, this will not have occurred. He must have agreed on several points, that he is being audited, that he is a preclear, that the auditor is an auditor. He must have agreed on this, and he must have agreed to some degree what Scientology is supposed to do for him. You see this? Must have agreed. If he hasn't agreed on these points, then his power of choice is being overset right at the beginning, and he isn't going to make headway. And you get this very mysterious circumstance of an individual evidently running the processes and techniques and getting no better. His power of choice is being overthrown at every auditing command. Follow me? All right, he's running a process, and he's running it very badly, and he wants to change. So he says, I want to change this process. I am no longer capable of running it. I just feel myself going by the boards. And at this moment, the auditor says, well, we've got to run it, and we've got to flatten it, because it says right here on page 1006 that the process must be flat before we change processes. And he just comes right down on the preclear with a thud. Preclear's power of choice is shot, and he will not further benefit from that process, but will worsen because of it. Why? Power of choice has been overcome, and this has then thrown into gear part of the reactive mind. An individuality has now been reactivated inside the individual, so that he's evidently a couple of guys now. That's the least that would happen to him. Well, how do you get around this? It's by continuing the goal of getting better with the free clear. You see, we continue this as a goal. And it's a goal upon which we're both working. And if we're not both working on this goal, and if we're not both in agreement on it, good heavens, we're not going to get any place. Well, you would be amazed what a pre-clear will give into an auditor's hands. Fantastic. Without his power of choice being upset at all, because he agreed to be audited, and this is auditing. Well, now, therefore, it's very necessary with a new pre-clear, or one who does not know too much about auditing or about Scientology, very, very necessary that the auditor at all times continue the basic agreement there is a session in progress, you see. That must be continued in existence. Therefore, other powers of choice become less important than that. But when the pre-clear is forced to do something which he believes he cannot do, and it's not worked up to on a gradient scale, he's bogging, he's having a hard time, or he considers that an ARC break has occurred, the session comes to end. And the basic agreement has to be arranged all over again. So we have to start the session. All over again. Why? We have to rehabilitate the power of choice to be audited. This is a great curiosity. Now, you shouldn't think at every turn that the pre-clear must be handled with kid gloves, but just to this degree he has to be handled with kid gloves. He must continue in agreement that a session is in progress. He must be given opportunities to break off the session. You understand that? He must occasionally be given opportunities to break off the session. The funny part of it is if he finds he can break it off when he wants to, he will stop trying. This is an interesting trick. Maybe the first couple of sessions, some pre-clear will just be muttering and one-fiving and one-oneing against the auditor. The auditor can ask him, well, now, do you want to, shall we stop the session now? Well, you agreed to be audited, and you wanted to be audited, but do you want now to stop? And the pre-clear will say, yes, I think I ought to. The auditor says, well, that's all right. Let's just make sure that you're okay and in present time, and we can stop the session. You'll be surprised that the pre-clear most always will go back into session by choice. He'll say, oh, well, all right. He found out he could stop the session. Now he's perfectly in agreement to go on. And he'll sometimes make this tentative test with you, particularly if he's in bad shape. He'll test you. Can he stop the session? Your answer to that is yes. See that? Now, why is it that you can get him to change his mind at all? It's because communication exists. Reason exists. Understanding exists. ARC exists. All of these things do exist, and these are not oversetting to an individual's power of choice. They can lead to it, however. You can use ARC with an individual and understanding and so on and get him into a series of agreements which you, therefore, thereafter victimize him with. That's possible. That's the best way in the world to make a pre-clear distrust ARC and understanding itself. See? We use it to get him into a situation and then use that established line to overset his power of choice. You recognize this as a good old messed universe trick? The dear souls area, if you want to go into parascientology and run that down sometime, one of the finest examples of this you ever heard of. Satan gets into this mess, and everybody loves him, and he's supposed to love everybody, and blah, glue, glue, you know. Boy, his power of choice is being so upset so continually that he never quite realizes where it all began, and it all began with force. He got caught in a force trap before he went through that, and everybody was so nice to him in getting him out that he decided to be friends with them. But whose trap was it? It was their trap. All right, you can only audit a pre-clear then to the degree that you wish to set him free. And when you yourself lose sight of that, you've lost sight of auditing and you will do a bad job of auditing. That's about all there is to it. Now, let's anatomize this power of choice a little bit more, and we find out that it has in it the element of expectancy. He chooses this because he expects that. Now, therefore, the auditor is the most successful, not just a good auditor, he's the most successful auditor, who at all times includes in the power of choice the expectancy of the preclear. What does the preclear expect? You would be amazed to find out that a preclear knows practically nothing of Scientology. He just simply walks in to get some auditing. You would be surprised what he really expects from auditing or what he expects will happen. He doesn't know whether it's an electric shock machine or whether or not he's going to have angels flying around in the room. He has no real idea, but he may have some idea which will not be his expectancy. See? Auditing will then not be his expectancy. Do you see that? What you're going to give him is not what he expected. So we have to clarify this up right at the outset. What does he expect? What does he expect to have happen? And therefore, we should then, very early in session, thrash out what auditing is all about, particularly with the new preclear. We expect this to happen or that to happen or something else to happen. You see? And that is why we have, at the beginning of an intensive, a paper to be filled out by the auditor on the preclear and a paper by the preclear to be filled out on the auditor. You see? These two pieces of paper, filled out then one by the other, establish a two-way flow and get some sort of an expectancy thrashed out. What does he expect from the session? Because if he expects nothing from the session, he's liable to get nothing, too. That's one reason. But that is a subordinate reason to this other one. If he expects angels to suddenly soar into the room and pull him out of his head or something of the sort, as probably has happened to him on the back track or something, he will tell you, if he expects this to happen and it doesn't happen, he isn't going to take any interest at all in your running 8C on him. See that? He's going to wonder when we stop dabbling around and get down to this thing called auditing, which is when the angels come in the window and yank him out of his head. See? Get the idea? Now, you would be amazed at some of the wild expectancies that preclears have. What you have is good enough, believe me. It can be dramatic enough, believe me. But it won't take place if the expectancy is different. Got it? See, if we have the wrong expectancy, then what you expect to have happen is not going to happen because the preclear is expecting something else to happen. Now, how can we change the preclear's? Well, we can think of a preclear we have right now who probably has the wildest expectancy anybody ever heard of, and it's probably being overset all the time, only he's never told anybody what the expectancy is, and nobody's ever told him what to expect. Now, it's probably the totality of why his case makes no gain. You see, it's not any complicated thing. Expectancy is part of power of choice, because choice, power of choice, to be becomes power of choice to do, becomes power of choice to have. And we have be, do, have. And they are the spheres of power of choice. See, it's just power of choice all by itself. That's just decision A, decision B, decision C. See, without any expectancy. But the moment we have be, do, and have, we have expectancy. He expects to be, do, and have certain things. So it's power of choice. Choice of beingness. Power of choice do is choice of doingness. Power of choice have is choice of havingness. And that's just about as far as you have to look, as far as power of choice is concerned. Now, the oddity is that the preclear gets into fantastically strong currents of force whenever you tick, click, or overset some old, overthrown power of choice. Could be said that the preclear who has pressure against some part of his anatomy is simply dramatizing his power of choice having been overcome. That's all. I mean, that's that. You say, all right, this preclear has a strong pressure on his shoulder. He has a somatic in his back. He has a crippled leg. That means that shoulder, back, leg are all reflecting moments when power of choice has been overcome. These things have individuality now, because they were more powerful than his power of choice. Now, the forces and pressures, then, and the deformations which the individual has, all stem from his power of choice having been overcome. Now let's take professional ambition. Professional ambitions are in this category, that the individual at no time is other than successful in his chosen ambition or field, regardless of what it demanded of him. You hear that now? An individual's always successful in his chosen field, regardless of what it demands of him, except when his original choosing of it has been interfered with. Tells you why a painter paints less well, why a writer writes less well, why an executive is less able as an executive. It's that being a painter or a writer or an executive or even a ditch digger as an original choice has then been interfered with. He said, I want to be a painter. And everybody said, no, you don't want to be a painter. Painters don't make any money. Painters get paint under their fingernails. And mommy said, hey, boy, wouldn't want paint under your fingernails, would him? Duh. And the kid says, well, I love mama, so mama can upset my power of choice, but it is my power of choice. And this can happen often enough that the individual at length can be only mama. See, mama's the only one who has power of choice, but mama isn't there anymore. Mama's a collection of energy, an energy mass, see? So here he goes. He got this? The individual can't be himself. To have any power of choice whatsoever, he has to dramatize somebody that overcame his power of choice, see? Somebody, preferably, who had some ARC with him at the time. And they used this ARC to overpersuade his choices. Now, it isn't that anyone ever had a natural choice. There is no such thing as a natural choice. This is odd, because it complicates the picture, but must be understood. There's no natural choice. An individual, we have been kidded about this since time immemorial. An individual doesn't really have natural talents. He has choices. And he generally will exhibit the most talent along that line which has been the least overset. And to this degree, an individual's ability in the arts or in work is overset by the reactive mind. In other words, all channels are shut except two, one of which is partially shut and the other is three-quarters open. So he becomes three-quarters of the line an executive in an advertising agency. Something on this order, you see. He has at the same time a feeling that he could draw, except that he was persuaded he couldn't in kindergarten. He has a feeling that he could probably play the piano, except that he's been punished for writing on the piano keys with a pencil or crayon. He has a feeling that he could do these other things, but somehow or another he just can't do them. He can't bring himself to do them. That's because they're on an automaticity. Force has been used to overcome his power of choice on those points. Now, if you want to know how talented an individual really is, go ahead and free up one totally on power of choice. Now, all of a sudden, he will start doing anything and everything you can think of. Of course, this is a very dangerous thing. We know we all have to be specialists, and everybody must exhibit very, very little talent. Because if we all didn't exhibit a very, very small amount of talent and so forth, well, there wouldn't be enough to go, well, you know, the old argument, that doesn't hold good either. An individual who has had his power of choice upset in the field of writing will dramatize no right to all writers. That he decided to write. It was overcome. Now he's in the vicinity of a writer. The only thing that will manifest itself is oversetting power of choice about writing. He either will abstain from comment or he will actively try to get the individual to choose not to write. Isn't that interesting? This is the way you set up a society so it'll run. You get everybody to overcome everybody else's power of choices. And that means that everybody in the society then will become less talented, which means society itself will be less talented, which means society itself will die. See how that would work? Now, you said an individual doing something, doingness, is a very good thing sometimes. We have somebody who wanted to be a pilot. And his power choice was overset. And we take him after a long time, and we teach him how to be a pilot. He won't be a very good pilot. But he can be made to be a pilot just by making him go through the actions of piloting, to take over the automaticities and choices and dramatize them this way and that way. And somehow or other, he'll work it out so that he's a halfway pilot. You know? His power of choice is still not entire. But he can fly somewhat up to the day when he crashes. He'll be passable. He'll be a standard issue 1955 type airline or military pilot. See? I mean, it's just awfully standard, awfully routine, pretty accident prone, pretty rough. Here's something funny. He gets into the military, which oversets and specializes in oversetting the power of choice. And the longer he is connected with the military or with a big airline company, which also works to overset his power of choice, the longer he's with this complete alteration, without anybody asking him once more if he'd like to be hired or be recruited. Nobody ever starts the session with him again, you see. And we get then less and less ability to fly. See, we're upsetting his power choice on several fronts. So on this one particular ability that's somewhat in the clear, he diminishes. Got it? Now, do you know that an individual may be almost entirely shut down, clear across the boards, except on being a pre-clear? His power of choice is to be a little better, and that's about all he can be. See, that's about all he can choose to be or do, you see. And if that little sphere is still open, he still wants to be audited, just that little tiny space left where his choice can operate, and you do a bad job of auditing on him, you've sunk him for keeps. Got it? Now, to do a good job of auditing, you do almost anything you want to do with him except overset his power of choice. To do a bad job of auditing, all you have to do is overset his powers of choice on this and that. And just ride these things hard. Yes, the individual dramatizes. Yes, the individual says bad things to the auditor. Yes, the individual wants to blow the session half the time. Yes, they're very unruly. They're very hard to manage, and so forth. They're a pain to the auditor. Yes, we can see clearly that he's being dragged out of the session by an engram. We just see this just as clean and clear, and we say, well, if we let the engram drag him out of the session, then he never will recover. Well, that's all very well, but it merely meant we were running him too high. That's all. That's all that means across the boards. We had trouble with him because we were running him too high. All we had to work with that he chose to be audited, and that was all there was left of this guy. Well, let's see if he can't choose something else without being thrown for a loop. Well, every time he chooses something new, he'll feel like he's being thrown for a loop. Every time his ability opens up in any direction, or he starts to look in some new direction, some old power of choice will come forcefully in upon him. Power of choice can be overset with two-way communication, with ARC, and with thought. It can be upset. It can be changed. And the individual just feel fine about it. See? He agrees to it. He says, yes, I can do this, I can do that. ARC, two-way communication, understanding, these things can be improved, and he will change his mind, increase his power of choice. You see that? It's only force, it's only duress, it's only making him stand still or making him move when he himself is really incapable of choosing it that'll upset him. See? So that we find a pre-clear who is made to wait 10 minutes by the auditor. He's practically in a spin when the auditor gets there to start the session. See that? I mean, that's fabulous. We say this person couldn't possibly be so bad off, they couldn't wait 10 minutes. Anybody can wait 10 minutes. Oh, no, they can't. All this pre-clear had left is power of choice. Was willingness to be audited. That was all, and the auditor made the pre-clear wait for 10 minutes. Well, that meant a stationariness against his power of choice. His choice was to be audited at 3 o'clock sharp, not at 3:10. And you'll spend the next hour or so trying to run this out. You've overset their power of choice because you've overset it with regard to time. They wanted to be audited. You had an agreement. And it was so delicate and so tenuous that when the session didn't instantly start at 3 o'clock, no new agreement was formed, you see. Nobody phoned them and said, be there at 3:10 or anything like that. Could be done. But they simply were made to stay motionless for 10 minutes. They have the definite conviction that force has been used upon them. That's how light force can be to be effective on such people. So the whole subject of auditing boils down to the establishment of a choice to be audited, one way or the other, to bring that into being, and having brought that into being, to continue to rehabilitate the choice of the preclear. Auditing then fails at any time that the preclear is unable to express himself when he is handled or manhandled, when he is not invited to have an opinion, when he is not invited to discuss what has happened, when he is not consulted concerning the process about to be run, when he is not consulted about the process which is about to be stopped. And therefore, the most intimate sphere of choice which he has interfered with fails. And he gets worse and he gets somatics. Every time you have an auditing break, every time you have an upset, it's because the preclear's power of choice was violated a little while before. What is his choice in the matter? Now, he can make choices in auditing, and it gives him practice in making choices. That is possibly one of the more valuable techniques, which is lying there wide open to view, something that you think you're maybe doing just because you want to be nice to the preclear. That's probably the most auditing that you get done, is letting the preclear exercise a power of choice with regard to what is going to happen, what's not going to happen. And the auditor is at all times torn between these two things, getting the job done, getting the maximum amount of auditing done, and keeping alive the preclear's power of choice and improving it. So the auditor is in control of the preclear until the preclear can exercise fully his powers of choice on the widest sphere. Do you know that a preclear could just be in a job, if you please? Just a job which overset his power of choice at all times, which would keep him so suppressed that his auditing given to him once a week would never really improve him. It would just keep him breathing. See, he'd just keep breathing. That's about all. He'd never come really upscale at all because everything was oversetting him between sessions. This could happen, you see. The environment could upset him faster than you could rehabilitate him. But then he must have in his environment some factor which is oversetting his power of choice continually. Now, there are probably, from this rationale, innumerable techniques. Innumerable, just on this line. But it starts first and foremost with this one factor that the auditor must consult with and agree upon with the preclear. Times of being audited, length of auditing session, and so on. The preclear usually, when he comes in, has an expectancy of being audited, let us say, for 25 hours in 1 week. Therefore, he's not going to be upset about the times. But if the times are established, they must be kept. Preclear may be kind of upset if the exact times appointed are not kept. And the auditor then should watch carefully to make sure that the preclear is still agreeing to be audited. And every time the preclear is no longer in agreement with being audited, the auditor ought to start the session all over again. He's got to. He's got to make a new agreement. And we get out of this such a thing as the communication bridge. Communication bridge, anatomy of, is a very simple thing. We discuss the fact that we are going to end the process we are running. We make sure that it is fairly flat. We make sure that the preclear isn't stuck to it or fixated on finishing it. We make sure that the preclear is cleared on the minor locks which may have accumulated running the process, and as he is now duly warned, we bring that process to a stop. Now, having done this, we discuss auditing in general to make sure that the session is still in progress and we are still in agreement with the pre-clear, that new thoughts and things to be discussed have occurred with the pre-clear, and we discuss them if they have. And then we announce to him that we are going to start another process. And having gotten an agreement upon this process and an understanding of what the process is and what the auditing command is going to be, we then give the first auditing command, make sure that it is understood, shepherd him through it, the original execution of it, and we are across the bridge. And unless we do this, slow down and stop the old one, clear it, clear the present time atmosphere, make sure the session is still in progress, give him warning of and discuss the coming process, give him a little test on it, talk to him about it, and then start it, unless we bridge these changes, we have overcome with violence the pre-clear's power of choice. Another thing, the pre-clear may be audited across a certain distance, which he may not like. Let's let him choose how far away and where the auditor is auditing him from. This is important. Introduced into Scientology against people's better judgment was the process of jumping up on top of the pre-clear, practically, and looking them straight in the eye. In other words, a collapsed terminal process. Some people, by the way, audit better this way, right up close. They know the auditor's there, you understand? But some people don't. And some discussion of the auditing distance should be discussed, because it's an important factor, and it itself could upset the pre-clear's power of choice. When the auditor moves his position in relationship to the pre-clear and they're both sitting still, he may be upsetting the living daylights out of the pre-clear's power of choice. He should give him some warning on it, and he shouldn't change his position or move things in the room or do something without having the pre-clear fairly flat. He must never leave the pre-clear waiting in a comm lag while he goes to answer the phone. This is very upsetting. It's the use of force on the pre-clear. That's the way it looks to the pre-clear. An auditor should realize the pre-clear is about 90% Anatin in his worst moments, and therefore cannot cope with the environment at all. And the auditor, by introducing new and extraneous factors into the environment, can practically crush the pre-clear. You would be amazed how much you are really expected to look out for the pre-clear's body and his environment while he is being audited. Every time you move unexpectedly, every time you assume a new position with relationship to the pre-clear, every time you change a process one to another, every time you agree upon something with the pre-clear, remember that it is done in agreement with the pre-clear. It is done with warning. The pre-clear is not as alert as he is when he's sitting there talking to you. Auditing today is a tremendously powerful thing. It has to be done in accord with its power. Now, we might one time have gotten away with sloppier auditing than we can get away with today. But the processes that we are using are so sweepingly powerful that they themselves can overcome with the greatest of ease the pre-clear's power of choice and simply drown him if they are improperly run. Therefore, today, to run today's process, we have to have a very savvy auditor. Not an auditor who pancakes around. Not an auditor who just lets the pre-clear choose everything and never handles or controls the pre-clear at all. But an auditor who has some understanding, some ARC, and who can handle two-way communication. And using these factors can get the pre-clear to exercise freer and freer power of choice with regard to life, and get a better and better clarification with the pre-clear of ARC and understanding and knowingness, all of which adds up to an increased power of choice. To control and not seem to control, to control in the direction of freedom, is a very, very interesting adjudication for an auditor to make. If he makes it well, if he does this well, he can just relax and sessions become a breeze and pre-clears get better all over the place, and life is beautiful indeed. If he does it badly, and it can be done badly, he'll be flabbergasted by the fact that his pre-clears have to have remedy of havingness. They have to be patched up, and eventually, after 199 hours of the most modern possible auditing, they are no bit better. Why? their power of choice was overcome faster than the technique could rehabilitate it. So we understand today what good auditing is. Good auditing is continuing in session a preclear with the intention of a continued improvement of the preclear's power of choice. Never at any time backing up or becoming upset because the preclear is going to make a new power of choice, or because the preclear's power of choice appear too unreasonable to be coped with. And handling the preclear with two-way communication and ARC and knowingness, and never at any time overcoming the preclear's actions by fixing him or moving him against his will. A good auditor today can make a good preclear better in an awful hurry, and with the same processes run very badly, oversetting the preclear's power of choice, the auditor today can make the preclear unimprove more rapidly than ever. So there is about the way auditing sits today, and that's the way you ought to audit. Thank you.